And continue on here, dealing with this issue related to the five kings that are fallen, the one that is, and the one that has not yet come. We rule out Nebuchadnezzar based on the fact that he's a believer, so could not ascend from the abyss, as per Daniel 4. 34 through 37, where he talks about this period in verse 33 of 7 years in which Nebuchadnezzar was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle. Again, a rare mental aberration known as boanthropy. There are documented cases of this in history, but it is certainly very rare. And God basically reduced this guy to a level of an animal in order to impress upon him that it is the Most High who rules. It is not arrogant men. Men have their positions of authority based only on the good pleasure of God. So at the end of that time period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason was returning to me. This was a process that didn't happen, you know, overnight. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever and ever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. But he does according to what he desires in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? And so Nebuchadnezzar, of course, becomes a believer, and God reestablished him. And verse 37, he acknowledges again that I praise, exalt, and honor the King of Heaven. For all his works are true and his ways are just. This is not just some unbeliever who got scared. This is a guy who really made a conversion. So we have to rule him out. 28, the most notable leader of Persia might be considered as a potential candidate. However, the Persian Empire never extended west further than Asia Minor. And also, too, if I were to name you 4 or 5 Medo-Persian leaders, largely the names would be unknown to you, and largely unknown to anybody in the modern world, because they were generally not famous. We do know from the study of Daniel that the initial kingdom was given to Darius, and people might know Darius or Cyrus. They might know those names, maybe, but they obviously are not famous in the sense that they would be known on a worldwide basis. And also, there is a geographic factor in here that we do have to consider, because the reality is this is all based very much in Europe. And so, as we have pointed out, this is not Europeans wouldn't necessarily accept somebody outside of their sphere. And so really, again, they didn't extend past Asia Minor at all. This was what caused the problem, the downfall of the Medo-Persian Empire, was the fact that they tried to get into Europe. And this is what ultimately brought Alexander down on them. So 30, Egypt does offer the very attractive option of having many famous pharaohs. However, once again, geographically, they have to be eliminated because their kingdom never extended far northward from the African continent. They occasionally dominated Palestine, but never into Europe. So the reality is here again, too, if you go look at the Egyptian king lists, you might recognize certain names. Ramses is a famous name. He's not the Pharaoh of the Exodus, as people have tried to suggest. He's not in the right dynasty, for one thing. And so, obviously, the most famous evil king of the Egyptian Empire was the one that enslaved the Jews and ultimately would not let them go. And the one who died under that was named Konkarus. And most people wouldn't know who he was if you told them. They've never even heard the name. So again, you have all this issue. Well, 31, the reason the geographic and racial issue must be given serious consideration is related to the fact that one would not expect Europeans to embrace a leader that was not European himself. And 32, this is documented by the current mentality expressed by the former French Prime Minister, who said, "I feel European. I want a Europe which affirms its own identity and stands out in the world." And this doesn't, they're not interested in compromising with other kingdoms, say Egypt or any of these others. And again, one of the issues here is that if you go into the Assyrian king list, how many people can name me one Assyrian king? Well, if you said Ashurbanipal, you're right. But that's about the only one most people are even kind of familiar with, and I'll bet you nobody here knew one. So how are you going to appeal to a world that is really very much geared towards celebrity if you yourself are not even known? It becomes a problem. So 33, it is an obvious fact that the only empire among the first five that was European in origin, as Rome was, is the Kingdom of Greece. 34, for this reason, we suggest the best candidate for the Antichrist is Alexander the Great, who is the most famous ruler from heads 1 through 5, and the only one who is European. And again, we suggest this. I don't have it written in granite that he's it, but he certainly fulfills all the qualifications of what we know Antichrist is going to have to be. Now, if it turns out it's not him and it's somebody that's even more famous than him, well, I'm fine. I don't have any problem with that. And so we do not make this a point of doctrine, a point of orthodoxy at all. We just suggest that this guy fulfills very much everything. And by the way, the world is still infatuated with this guy. I mean, there are hundreds and maybe thousands of websites devoted to him. There was a deal that came through here many years back. It wasn't here, but it was up in St. Pete, which I got to see twice. It was very fascinating, and it was a full-blown exposition on Alexander and his military conquests and all of that and all the things he did. And he fully believed he was the Son of God. There's no question about that. The oracle at Siwa basically told him that he was destined to rule the world. And literally, in the space of a very, very few years, he conquered the entire known world pretty much from Greece all the way to India. And then, of course, died some mysterious death there that no one can account for. And his life was tragically cut short. We say tragically, as the world would see it. But the fact is, he really fully believed that he was destined to rule the world. And he didn't get to. I mean, he conquered the known world of his day, but not the entire world. So 35, the beast that was and is not is now identified as an eighth king, indicating that he will receive his position out of the seventh and final kingdom. 36, this simply means that the seventh kingdom will be established and have a functioning leader, who will be replaced at some point by the resuscitated Antichrist. 37, that he is one of the seven, indicates that he must come from the pre-Roman past. Again, since he was and is not at the time John records this. 38, while many interpreters suggest this is a reference to Domitian, who was the Roman king in power, the Caesar at the time of John's writing, who is regarded as one of the seven because he was considered a second Nero. This does not fit the fact that the beast was and is not. Domitian certainly existed at that time. And so how one could say he is not, is to me, you've got to do some real mental semantic gyrations to get around that. He was already on the scene historically. He hadn't died and come back. We don't believe that Domitian was Nero revived. Most students of history don't believe that. Not just doctrinally we don't believe it, but most people don't believe that. And the fact is they don't believe it because it's not true. 39, the end of verse 11 simply supplies us a summary statement about the end of Antichrist. We are not told anything here of his career, merely about his destruction. We saw that again in verse 8, that he is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. Doesn't really deal with his career as much here. It kind of glosses over all that and goes right to the fact that he's going to be destroyed eventually. 40, while the Greek noun apolia can refer to physical destruction, here it is used of the final eternal destruction. that is visited on the souls of all unbelievers as they suffer by association with Satan and his angels, as per Matthew 25, 41. And 41, the destruction of Antichrist is a part of the divine decrees and is the subject of prophecy, Daniel 9, 27. And as we have pointed out, there are certain things, when you look at prophecies, there are prophecies that are, in effect, written in granite. They cannot be changed. There are prophecies that are contingent upon certain things. For instance, if you remember Jonah, the wayward prophet, he was commanded to go and cry out against Assyria and to let them know that they were going to come to Nineveh, their capital city, and let them know that God was going to take them down. And Jonah didn't want to do it because he was afraid they would change their mind, and he hated the Assyrians, and he wanted God to kill them, and he was afraid if they heard the good news and believed in God that God might relent. Well, in fact, that's what happened. And so Jonah recognized that there was a potential for something being changed in this pronouncement of doom that he's going to make against Assyria, against Nineveh specifically, the capital of Assyria. And so there are certain things that are, we might say, a part of God's divine decrees, that before the foundation of the world, certain things he determined were going to happen. Now, he did all this, of course, without violating human volition. He doesn't force anybody to do anything. And one of the closest things we'll get to that is at the end there of chapter 17 in Revelation, where it says God puts this into their hearts to do thus and such. And the idea is, he plants the idea, but they decide whether or not to go ahead and do it. Like, I can give you an idea, hey, let's go do thus and such. Well, you have to make the final call. You can't say, well, Ron made me do it. And, you know, little kids try that when they get in trouble. Why'd you do that? Well, Joe made me do it. Well, how did he make you do it? Nobody makes you do anything. Well, God plants the idea, and they just are all too happy to run with it, as we will see. So Daniel 9, 27, and here, like at the end of actually verse 26 even, is a good example. Even to the end, a war is decreed with desolations, is a better translation than what you have in the New American Standard even. It's decreed. They use the word determined. And God knows exactly what's going to happen. So here in verse 27, you have Antichrist. He, the Antichrist, will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. And so in the middle of Daniel's 70th week, he institutes a seven-year treaty, knowing, you would suspect, that he only has 3.5 years left. And in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And that's right here, of course, at the midpoint when he becomes Satan-possessed. The middle of Daniel's 70th week. But here, when he says he makes a covenant for many, most people try to make him hack the covenant back here, and they make Daniel's 7 years of Daniel's 70th week the same as the 7 years of the treaty. That's not it. He makes the treaty for 7 years here at the midpoint. But in the middle of Daniel's 70th week, he put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on a wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate. And as we pointed out, the abominations are the Jewish rejection of Messiah that ultimately culminates in their actual embrace of Antichrist, of the Satan man. They've rejected the God man, and they embrace the Satan man. And they've committed these types of things. And this God views as an abomination. Will come one who makes desolate, even to a complete destruction. One that is decreed is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Antichrist is the one who makes desolate. He's called, in fact, the abomination of desolation, or the desolating abomination, depending on how you view those adjectives there. Also, 2 Thessalonians 2:8, we see his end is decreed. And this is one of the reasons. Now, this shows a pretty good example here of why you've got to look at the Scripture as a whole. The prophetic word cannot be isolated in any one verse. You have to have a pretty good grasp of a lot of things to be able to put all this together. And I see exegetes on these various lists and things I see, and they'll take one verse and they isolate on it. You've got to take all these other factors into consideration. 2:8, then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will neutralize with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. And so the Lord himself destroys Antichrist, as we will see, that we will get when we get in a little further in Revelation. And also Revelation 19, those are the verses that detail the exact destruction, verses 19 and 20. And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. And the beast was seized. Now, we're not told who seized him, but it's the Lord himself. And with him the false prophet, who performed signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast. And these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire that burns with brimstone. So, there you have the final decreed destruction being poured out. Now verse 12, and the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. And Kai, the ten horns, Deka is the word for ten, and then Keras, the term for horns, K-E-R-A-S, which relative pronoun host you saw, aorist indicative of Idon, are ten kings. Again, adjective Deka for ten, and then Basileus. R is the present indicative of Imi. Who is actually this adjective here, Hostis, which is actually a compound between tis, which means a certain one, and host, the relative pronoun. And the word kind of have the idea of such a kind as. These kings are such a kind. As a kingdom. A kingdom is accusative feminine singular of Basileia. Basileus is a king. Basileia is a kingdom. These ten kings have not yet received a kingdom. In other words, none of these kings is historically on the scene when John gets this information. They are relegated to some time in the future. Now, John's not told when, but they will receive. Here, they have not yet, adjective, adverb here, hupo, not yet or still, H-O-U-P-O, they have not yet received, actually that shouldn't have an H on it, that's a smooth breathing, so it should be O-U-P-O, not yet received is lambano, again here, to take hold of is what the word means. In this power, they have not assumed power in this context. They have not received a kingdom, but, adversative conjunction, Allah, strong adversative in fact, but authority, they will receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. But authority, exousia, first means the right of freedom of choice. It means the right to act, the right to make decisions. And it comes to mean authority, because those who are in authority can make decisions and pronouncements that those under their authority need to follow. And so we all have authority at some level. The very fact that you have volition gives you authority over yourself. You get to choose your course in life. You get to choose your path. And so you have your own authority. But now, God provides other authorities in the Scripture. For instance, just because you have volition, this doesn't give you the right to blow off other authorities. Because that just simply makes you a law to yourself. And this is one of the real dangers of people. They become a law to themselves. If they think it is right, if they do it, it's right. And you cannot do that. You can, but it's dangerous, spiritually and physically dangerous. You may have run across people like this in the physical realm who become laws to themselves. They just do whatever they choose to do. Damn the consequences, they're just going to do it. You know, that's their deal. Well, you've got volition, and so you have authority. But then there are other authorities provided. For instance, if you're a woman and you're married, your husband's your authority. If you're a child, your parents are your authority. If you go to school, your teachers are your authority. If you live in this world or are in Sarasota city limits, those police are your authority. In the county, those police are your authority. And then in the spiritual realm, you have authorities given the deacons, or authorities in the local church with respect to the physical issues and the direction in which we do things in that regard. And if a deacon gives you a directive, you should obey it. You know? But what do most people do? Well, who the hell does he think he is? Giving me a guide and telling me what to do. Well, he's got the authority to. And then you have the authority of the pastor teacher. Then you have the authority, obviously, of the Lord himself. And so you have these divine institutions and these authorities. Yes, you've got authority over yourself. We do not debate that. Again, we are strict about volition that, hey, God provided you free will, but you better use it wisely is what we warn you. Just because you got authority doesn't make you infallible. Doesn't make any authority infallible just by having authority. So here they receive authority, the right to act as kings. Again, relative pronoun host comparing us here. As kings, basileus, into an hour. Or literally for 1 hour. I'm sorry, it's not ice, it's ice. The number one, and then hora, the word for hour. 1 hour. Again, we have shown repeatedly in this book, and only in this book, can the term 1 hour be technical, and it represents the whole of Daniel's 70th week, the final 7 years. And I say, when I say of human history, I recognize human history is going to continue into the millennium. But as REM said, it's the end of the world as we know it, and the world is going to be changed dramatically in the millennium. It's not going to be the same human history we've seen for the last 6,000 years. You'll have the Lord ruling from Jerusalem. Animals will lose their ferocity. People, longevity will be extended. People, if you don't live to be 100 years old, they're going to think you're cursed and all that. So things will be changing. When I say the end of human history, I'm talking about history as we know it. And so they receive authority with the beast for 1 hour. They receive, as Lambano again, to take hold of, to receive, 1 hour with the beast. Preposition meta, this denotes accompaniment, and then the word again, therion. Authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. Verse 13, these have one purpose. And they give their power and authority to the beast. These are, again, in context, the ten kings we're talking about, the ten horns, near demonstrative adjective hutas. These have one purpose. You got the numeral one here plus the word nome, which is interesting because it's not used very much, G-N-O-M-E. Nine times it's used. It means the faculty of knowing. Mind, reason, can come into as you think through something, your opinion about something, if you're making a plan, your purpose or your intention. And that kind of covers this whole thing. The purpose, they have one intention. Now, the question becomes, first, it's very hard to get anybody organized anytime. But here you got 10 kings, 10 leaders of these nations, and they all are on the same page, interestingly enough, we might say. And they're all headed in the same direction. And they got one idea. And what is their idea? Well, fairly simply put, it's global domination. And let's face it, what have all leaders of all history, of all time, really wanted deep down? They've wanted to rule the world. Do you think, and when you look at politicians, you see that many, many, many of them are on a power trip. And they like the idea of power. And there are people that are attracted to that. There are people that are hangers-on that pursue the power structure because they like being close to the power. And so these guys have the same ideas, we might say, or the same plan as many kings have throughout history. They want to rule the world. And they want a world, in fact, where they are at the 10, would be up here at the top, and everything else would flow out from there. Which I guess is nice if you can get it, but they're not going to get it. So they have, these have one purpose, having. Present active indicative of the simple verb to have, echo. And chi, Their power is dunamis, and that's what this word means, is the ability to act. It's known as power, not maybe strength, not how strong you are, but the fact that you can do something. Their ability, their power, and chi, their authority, exousia again, of them, genitive of autos, to the beast, dative here of therion, they give, present active indicative of didymi. They do it willingly. They're not coerced into this. Now, again, if you're trying to rule the world, why would they give all this power to one man? Because they believe he is their best chance of pulling this off. And they are committed to it. They're all on the same page. And to them, it all just makes perfect sense. Okay, point one here. The teaching angel now moves to the prophetic significance of the ten horns, which were seen in chapter 13 and are now explained here. Two, as one might expect, there is some diversity of opinion as to how the ten horns of the beast are to be understood. A, the historicist position tends to identify the ten kings as ten kingdoms, which existed in 532 A.D. Now, how they picked that number, I don't know, but they do. And so they include the Anglo-Saxons, the Franks, the Alaman Franks, the Burgundic Franks, the Visigoths, the Suevi, the Vandals, the Ostrogoths, Bavarians, and Lombards. B, the preterist positions, interpreters, have varied opinions about the horns, with David Clark suggesting that the kings were countries subjected by Rome. So they would view the ten horns as Roman vassals, we might say. C, Adams indicates that he understands the ten horns to represent the provincial governors, who first gave their support to Rome and in turn received authority from her. Now that's one of the interesting things here that we are told. When it says the ten horns received their authority as kings, it doesn't say who gave them that authority, but clearly the issue is that God did it. This is one of the things we hold to. Again, kingdoms don't rise and fall accidentally in history. Acts 17 there says, Paul told them, God determines their boundaries and the times of their habitation. And so here he's got the Rome and these kings sort of interplaying with their own authority, which is not correct. Russell concludes, D, that this symbol denotes the auxiliary princes who were allies of Rome and took commands during the Jewish War. And in E, both Russell and Chilton do not take the number as literal, but as mystic or symbolic of something else. So the fact that there are ten kings is irrelevant. Now that's another whole thing you'll get, and this very much comes out of the spiritual or idealist school of interpretation. Numbers in Revelation don't mean anything, they would tell you. So then when you see the 144,000 Jews, 12,000 from each tribe, well, that doesn't mean 144,000. Yes, it does. When you see the seven angels having the seven last plagues, the number seven means something. There are seven of them. When you see these ten kings, the number ten isn't a figure for something else. It's ten. And so you have all these numbers. And the idea is, like if you look later on ahead when we get into the New Jerusalem in chapter 21, verse 12, it had a great high wall with 12 gates. Well, 12 doesn't mean 12. But what does it mean? Well, then it becomes just an interpreter's nightmare. Anybody can say it means anything. It had 12 gates, and at the gates stood 12 angels. And the names are written on them, which are the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. And there were three gates on the east, three on the north, three on the south, and three on the west. It sounds like it's a square to me, but we can't conclude that. And the wall of the city had 12 foundation stones. Well, not 12, really. Well, see, if you start throwing the numbers out in Revelation that they don't mean anything, then the book, how are you going to interpret it? And they have the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. We can't conclude that there were only 12 legitimate apostles, can we? You have to from this verse. I just went through that this week on one of the lists. Somebody said, well, anybody could be an apostle. Anybody could be an apostle? Really? How come it says there's only 12 of them at the end then? And how come, you know, when Jesus picked them, he only picked 12? Now, he knew Judas was an unbeliever. He knew that. And there were reasons spiritually and doctrinally why he had to have Judas there. One of the things Judas certainly shows is that you can't coerce volition. Judas was exposed to the ministry of the Son of God for 3.5 years, just like the other guys were, and he never believed. He never accepted the fact that Jesus was the Messiah. And he died and he went to hell. What does that show? If I was perfect, if I was the Son of God, I couldn't change your volition. You would be what you are. So the city, verse 16, is laid, and he gave me a gold measuring rod, verse 15, to measure the city. But guess what? These measurements don't mean anything, according to some interpreters. And he measured the city, Iran, 1,500 miles, its length and width and its height are all equal. And this has led to two conclusions. Either the city is laid out as a cube, you know, or the city is laid out, they would say, as a pyramid. I don't know that you can tell, but, you know, in a pyramid, the base of it, the length and the width would be identical, and the height would be the same as the length and the base. So again, I don't know that you would want to argue about that. And they measured its wall, 72 yards according to human measurements. But 72 doesn't mean 72. Well, 72 yards, the wall is nearly as thick as a football field, which is, you know, about 3/4 of a football field, which are also angelic measurements. And so anyway, you know, the whole point is that if you throw the numbers out in this thing and just begin to say, well, these numbers don't mean what they say they mean, you've got a lot of problems. Well, F, the idealist interpreters like Wilson see the 10 kings as referring to the kings of the East. Although they're, you know, clearly when they're identified, as in that passage we saw, they're identified as the kings of the East. While Summers identifies them as the power of the Roman Empire in John's day. G. Alford sees the kings as a future coalition of 10 European kingdoms that will grow out of the fourth beast of Daniel. Alford is right. Alford got it. The futurists, like Walford, see these 10 kings in contrast to the 7 heads of the beast, as kings who rule not in succession, but simultaneously at the end of time. That is also correct. The first 7 kings were 7 historical kingdoms, and they extend throughout history. The final 10 kings on the horns all come at the end of history. They're not here throughout history. So to look for them throughout history leads you in the wrong direction, because they're here as kings with the beast for 1 hour, and that's a very specific period of time. So I, most dispensationalists, equate these 10 horns with the 10 toes of the image in Daniel 2. That is correct. They are the same. And the 10 horns on the fourth beast in Daniel 7. That is correct as well. They are the same. The number 10 keeps popping up in this thing because there are 10 of them. So 3, as has consistently been the case in this book, we must allow the text to speak for itself and consider each detail in context. For ironically, if one studied all the interpretations of this book, he would likely find the truth. Now, have you got time to do this? No, you don't. That's why I get the job. By sifting through the individual passages that a given interpreter got correct. And so, at certain times, you're going to find that all these guys can be right about a given passage. The problem is realizing when they start injecting their own ideas. That becomes the problem. And so one of the things you have to look for is, one, if the truth's out there, again, I don't have to reinvent the wheel all the time. If Alford got it correct, he got it correct. I don't have to improve on that. I mean, other than if he missed some detail or something that I see. But generally speaking, again, hundreds, thousands, maybe millions of interpreters have been through this book. We have a body of work to work from. And while it's not perfect, the reality is, what I've seen in every one of these verses is that somebody got it right. Again, to have to wade through all it, you're going to have hundreds of commentaries and be able to read the languages and do all that, but you could sift through this. I mean, not maybe you couldn't do it personally, but it could be done, is all I'm saying. And so, again, if they got it right, they got it right. 5, a horn in the Word of God is a symbol for power. Particularly the royal power that resides in the leader of a kingdom. As per 1 Samuel 2:10, we see this in the Old Testament. Those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king. He will exalt the horn of his anointed. The horn of his anointed is a reference to the king, where the king there is called a horn. Psalm 132:17. You have there in that Samuel passage an example of synonymous parallelism, which a guy will make a statement in one passage, one verse or one line, and then turn around and expand on it or elaborate on it in the next line, but they're both referring to the same thing. Psalm 132:17. Then I will cause the horn of David to spring forth. Again, a reference to his royal power. I have prepared a lamp for my anointed. His enemies I will clothe with shame, and upon himself his crown shall shine. Jeremiah 48:25. The horn of Moab has been cut off, and his arm broken, declares the Lord. Make him drunk, for he has become arrogant towards the Lord. So Moab will wallow in his vomit, and he will become a laughing stock. Again, the power, the royal power of Moab is going to be taken down by God. And then Daniel 8, 5 and 8, where we saw on that, what we call the nondescript beast. Oh, no, I'm sorry, this is another one, but we do see 10 horns on the beast in Daniel 7. But then in Daniel 8, we see the royal power symbolized in verse 5. While I was observing, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. A notable leader, we would say. And that notable leader was Alexander the Great. The goat is Greece. And then verse 8, then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, a reference to the destruction of the royal power of Alexander. And in its place came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. And again, the dissolving of the empire of Alexander and the division of it among his four leaders, Ptolemy, Antigonus, Cassander, and Seleucid. And each got their little area of the empire in which they ruled. So horns are a pretty regular figure here. And if you look actually back up, you can see the ram in verse 3. The ram, which represents Medo-Persians. Now, the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. To tell you that the royal power of the Medo-Persian Empire really reside in the Persians. The Medes were there first. But the greater power resided with the Persians. And that second horn coming up last being bigger indicates that the royal power in the Medo-Persian Empire really came through the Persians. So 6, it is so used in this context since the angel makes it explicit that the horns represent 10 kings that have not received their kingdom at that time. 7, again, one must recognize that the angel is speaking to John in real time. I mean, real time as we would talk about it, and now. When we talk about now, we got to talk about John's now as he's hearing this. And the various words that relate to time in this chapter must be interpreted from John's perspective. Again, the Bible must be interpreted in the time in which it was written first. And so in the time, and that's why we see when you get into this prophetic information, how could a guy like, say, John, who lived in 100 A.D., how could John communicate the concept of rockets or nuclear war or space travel or microwaves or any of the other things that you and I take for granted in everyday life? And the fact is, he could only communicate this through language that he had. And it had to be in language of his time. And we'll see all that as we get more and more into this, too. So, therefore, the beast that was and is not, again, existed prior to the time John is hearing this, but did not exist on the stage of human history in 96 A.D. when he's writing it. 9, when it states that he will arrive and that people will be astonished. It is speaking of a time that is future from the time that John is receiving this information. And 10, in that same vein, when John is informed that these 10 kings have not yet received a kingdom, it is to be understood that they have not received their right to rule at the time John records this. And 11, the immediate context, which we will deal with more in this explanation, clearly states that these 10 kings will engage in open warfare with the Lamb, which mandates that these 10 kings be placed chronologically at the time just prior to the second advent. To look for fulfillments of this in 500 A.D. is fruitless, because these are going to engage in open warfare against the Lamb in verse 14. These will wage war against the Lamb, these kings, these 10 in context, and the Lamb will overcome them. And also you see it again in 19:19. We saw that just a little bit earlier. The beast and the kings of the earth and their armies. And that phrase goes beyond just the 10 we've got here to encompass other kings as well, but the fact is these have to be placed at Second Advent. You can't place them historically any other time. And 12, as we have previously noted, the composite beast is designed to portray Satan's agenda throughout history, the seven heads, along with his specific agenda in the final 7 years of Daniel's 70th week, the 10 horns. The final political alliance that is going to characterize all this is seen in the 10 horns. And 13, in order to fully appreciate what is related here, one should have a previous understanding of the mysterious beast that was introduced in the book of Daniel, which we will review here, and we're going to stop there today. But I plugged that in here, and we will look at Daniel again briefly, and then resume this exposition with point 14 later on in the notes. So don't get confused there, and we'll deal with that. But for now, it is our quarterly. We observe the ritual of the Lord's table, and that is today. So if you want to get everything in position so that we can engage in this ritual.